Hi, everybody, and welcome to Two Off the First for today. It is September the 13th, 2022. I'm Ryan Ballingy. We are presented by our friends at French Lick Resort. Thanks for joining us. We got two stories for you. I'm back after a little bit of a golf vacation, buddy's trip. It was a fill-in, we'll play the role of the rando on the trip at the 8-Ball Invitational out of Big Cedar Lodge out in Missouri. We had a great time. Maybe we'll talk about that on another podcast for another day, but we got a couple of stories to get to. One, a little bit of retrospect, looking back at the BMW PGA Championship from over the weekend. And then another, looking forward a little bit to what could be a catastrophic failure at one of the biggest golf courses, one of the biggest golf resorts in the United States. So let's start with BMW PGA Championship. Obviously, you know the result. Shane Lowry won for the first time since his Open Championship triumph in 2019. Huge win for him. Great accomplishment. As he said, one for the good guys. Had a really great social media video after, kind of detailing all of the night-long drinking that happened after the win, which is exactly what should happen when you win like that. Rory McIlroy missed an eagle putt on the final hole to give himself a look at a playoff, winds up one short. Rahm being a part of it as well. Really, really good event. Obviously, Rahm shot 62 in the final round way earlier than the true showdown between McIlroy and Lowry. Nevertheless, great tournament, really fun to watch, and you had quite an interesting mix in there. I mean, obviously, you had the storylines going into the week and really continuing throughout the weekend about the LIV players taking part. Well, LIV players were part of the equation. I mean, Patrick Reed was right there in the end. Lee Westwood was there. Taylor Gooch had a piece of the action. So the LIV guys represented themselves pretty well in terms of quality of play. They played this week. They are in what they're calling their Chicago event. It is not in Chicago. It's a town called Sugar Grove, Illinois, about an hour and a half away, depending on your traffic. But the place is Rich Harvest Farms, which has hosted the LPGA in the past. It's been a major championship site. So this club seems to have an affinity for LIV. They've talked about on their social media channels how proud they are to host the LIV series. That's coming up. Well, one of the guys who's going to be there is Sergio Garcia, obviously a contract guy with LIV. And Sergio is taking on the chin, and probably deservedly so, to be honest, for what he decided to do in withdrawing from this tournament after, an opening 76. So the week is obviously thrown into flux. Queen Elizabeth II passed away. Word came out about that while I was on the plane to Big Cedar on Thursday afternoon. And that kind of upended the event to a degree, right? I mean, they suspended play right then and there as soon as word came out on Thursday. I think that was a national sign of respect just to stop the country, stop the kingdom at that point, and let the news kind of sink in and let whatever monarchy traditions take place to allow the passage of the throne to King Charles III, who's now King Charles III instead of just Charles. And then they decided, okay, well, we're going to can play on Friday as well, and then we'll figure out what to do. Again, sign of respect thing. And so they said, okay, well, we're going to reduce it to 54 holes, and we're going to play Saturday and Sunday. And if we don't get it done Saturday and Sunday, we might not finish this thing whatsoever because of all the logistics that go into this state funeral that's coming for Queen Elizabeth II, all the processions and different movements of people around the country, around the kingdom. As her casket moves around, as the royals move around, a lot of stuff going on. So this, look, 54 holes if we get it in. If not, see what happens. So you got Garcia, who shoots 76. He withdraws from the event after it's suspended. And then what does he do? He shows up at the Texas-Alabama football game on Saturday in Austin, Texas with his wife. And he posts a picture on social media with the hook'em horns. And he's on the field level and he took a lot of grief for that because he took a spot away from somebody in the field, right? He was there to get world ranking points, probably to a large degree. And that's not to say he wasn't trying to, in some fashion, be supportive of the DP World Tour. I don't know the man's intentions in his heart, but it comes across from a certain perspective that you didn't want to play in the DP World Tour the second you signed with LIV. You've been quoted anonymously, been quoted from an anonymous player saying you all should have taken the F and Saudi money to his fellow DP World Tour players when he got guff for his return, in Germany. So you can kind of get the sense that, yes, while he may have been loyal to the European Tour in the past, he doesn't necessarily hold that loyalty now. This is really an opportunity to play competitive golf, maybe a chance to earn world ranking points, maybe a chance to maybe just get back in the good graces of some people, start thinking about the Ryder Cup, all these different types of things. I mean, there's probably a lot of thoughts going through every player's head every week, but for the LIV guys, there's a lot of priorities that they have to sort through. They have to sort through their public reputation. They have to sort through earning the money that they have on their contract, whether that's an earnout or whether that's all paid up front. Seems like it's different by the guy. You got to figure out world ranking points, how you're going to formulate a schedule that isn't just LIV events. And you know, for Sergio, being a former Masters champion, he obviously has the Masters. And then you've got the end of his exemption because you got 5 years from when you win. So 18, 19, 20, 21, 22. You get 5 years in the other three majors when you win a major. Well, that ended this year. So he's got to be in the top 50 in the world or he only gets the one major. And I'm assuming, by the way, that Augusta National is not going to tell players who qualify in the top 50 in the world that they can't play. It's just not good for business. I don't think that they're going to do it, even with how much I am well aware Fred Ridley absolutely hates the idea of LIV and would love to tell these guys to go to hell, basically, in public. But he can't do that. That just doesn't work for the Masters brand, so he's probably going to have to live with it and let the world golf ranking do its thing. Well, Garcia was trying to let the world golf ranking do its thing. If he played well enough, earned enough points, then you couldn't keep him out of the other majors because top 50, top 60 get into the others. So it might have bought him some time to sink from, you know, have points that are going to come off throughout the course of the year. So now you're thinking about U.S. Open and PGA Championship because top 60 get into the U.S. Open. Effectively, the PGA of America invites top, really 100, but top 50 easily get in. So those points come off between now and then. They change in value. So you've got Garcia, who was probably playing this event for a couple different reasons, but primarily thinking about the here and now. And then he shows up in UT Austin, which was a great game, by the way. And unfortunately, now he finds himself in hot water and just, again, and John Rahm was particularly upset about it because it took away a spot from a fellow Spaniard. So a guy who's trying to keep his status on the European Tour, on the DP World Tour, this is a huge event. It's an $8 million purse. The points go up a ton. The DP World Ranking Tour points or World Tour points are really what keep you going. It's not the money list anymore, but the points are huge. And this guy doesn't get in because Sergio wanted to play and then decides, Queen died. I don't feel like dealing with this. Waiting two extra days to get sent to the curb because he probably figured, I'll shot 76 on Thursday. I can just play Friday, take the PJ home, get there in time for Saturday. Everything's going to be great. Instead, finished the first round and then decided, okay, I'm out of here. Well, okay. Probably not a great thing. So, according to the Telegraph, there is a very realistic possibility that he's going to be fined. And so the DP World Tour can pursue that. Per the Telegraph's reporting, that has to be shared. The rationale for that fine has to be shared with Garcia and his management within 21 days. We don't know what's going to happen there, whether that's just because of how it looks or because he didn't give a really good... I mean, you really don't have to give a reason. I believe on the European Tour, on the PGA Tour, you have to give a reason. You can't just say, I'm withdrawing. You have to say, I'm withdrawing because. Now, you can make up an injury. You can say, oh, my big toe hurts and lie about it. But you got to give a reason. So, I don't know. Anyway... and the Telegraph piece is pretty interesting. A couple of kind of anonymous quote type things. That's where we're at in all of this. Some people want to go on the record. Some people don't. But apparently a high profile player, whoever that was, told the Telegraph, quote, however you look at it, this is two fingers up from Garcia to the tour. Two middle fingers. He came to Wentworth saying he wanted to, quote, support the tour, but was obviously annoyed at what DP World Tour CEO Keith Pelley said. And then on Wednesday, would totally excuse you for not listening to the State of the Tour from Keith Pelley or Jay Monahan, for that matter, of the players. But Pelley said, or made a comment in reference to what Sergio Garcia said as kind of the DP World Tour becoming a feeder tour to the PGA Tour and to, I guess, eventually LIV, but to the PGA Tour, because now the top 10 players in DP World Tour points at the end of the season will get access to the PGA Tour with a PGA Tour card. And Garcia said, well, why are we turning the European Tour into a feeder tour? Which, by the way, Sergio Garcia was one of the people who turned the European Tour into a feeder tour to the PGA Tour, because that's been going on for a generation now. This is not new stuff. This is exactly the same. But Pelley said, quote, can we please just stop the feeder tour nonsense once and for all? And as to the point of heading towards being the world's fifth tour, one of our members who is playing here this week actually said that. It's unbelievable, end quote. And I think Pelley's willing to call these guys out. Like, if you want to come here and complain about the DP World Tour after taking the LIV money, you have no standing because you took the money. So how are you helping the problem? You are in essence creating a feeder tour. You are in essence docking the reputation of the DP World Tour. So either put up or shut up kind of thing. And I think that's probably true. I mean, that's probably the proper way to look at it. Now, I will say, there was an interesting piece from Alistair Tate. Used to work at Golf Week, runs his own blog now for the last couple of years. Now, Alistair has a different slant on LIV. I think he doesn't necessarily see it as a good thing, but he also doesn't see it as a bad thing. He kind of sees it as a thing that needs to be reconciled and that both sides are not without blame. Now, the both sidesism thing don't work for me. That's just not going to happen here. But he does make some interesting points. And as I've said before, you can learn something by reading something or hearing from people you disagree with. And I think Alistair made some interesting points that basically this whole thing about LIV proper and money, well, he's referencing the prior generation. He's referencing the guys like Westwood and Keimer and Garcia and Poulter, guys who made tons and tons of starts on the DP World Tour. Now, mind you, he also doesn't reference the fact that a lot of those were co-managed or co-branded events, co-sanctioned events with the PGA Tour between the majors and the WGCs. I mean, that's 6, 7, 8 a year, depending on what part of the cycle we were in the scheduling of the WGCs. But nevertheless, okay. So, you know, they played in 6 to 10, let's put it that way, European Tour events per year that weren't the majors or WGCs. And so Tate is saying, okay, well, these guys have been loyal all these years. You should let them continue to play in DP World Tour events because they were loyal then. But he kind of leaves out the disloyalty part now and fundamentally trying to undermine that tour. So I think where I disagree with Alistair is that latter point is, okay, you've got a tour now that is kind of being undermined by so many of its foundational players leaving because they didn't really care, or they don't really care because they took the money. They know full well the consequences of, or at least potential consequences of that choice, not being able to play in the Ryder Cup, not being able to captain a Ryder Cup team, not being able to potentially compete in DP World Tour events. And they just assume it's going to be totally cool for them to come back and play and have no issues doing so. When they say, oh, we're independent contractors, we should be able to do exactly what we want to do if we're eligible for it. The problem is the other way. Guys who are on the DP World Tour or the PGA Tour or whatever that didn't sign up for LIV or didn't get approached by LIV or anything like that, they can't just waltz over to Rich Harvest Farms this weekend and Monday queue in. They can't get a sponsor invite or whatever. You're either in or you're not. So it's guys from what have effectively become a closed shop in LIV saying, well, we should be able to go to any shop, but you can't come in ours. And I think that's the big piece of controversy here that's starting to kind of take shape. And until there's a recognition of that, I think from the LIV folks, the chirping's going to keep going. That's not going to stop. I think there probably needs to be some come to Jesus style meeting with the LIV players and go, just look, their best path to success lives, in my opinion, is to just be their own tour, be their own thing. Now, you can get together at the majors. I think that's effectively what they're going to become at this point for the next 3-5 years, is the meeting place of these two, three, depending on how you think about it, tours. But I think Liv's best bet is to say, look, we are a tour with no history. We just made up events out of the blue. We made up team names out of the blue. We paid people a whole boatload of money. Let's just lean into that. Let's really lean into that and create these outrageous events. And we'll call them our majors. You could have, instead of a 14-event schedule with 13 $25 million purses and one $50 million purse, have an 18-event schedule if you can figure it out, and have 14 events of $25 million, two of $50 million, and two of $100 million. I don't know. But if it were that amount of money, people who are kind of enamored with money or the concept of earning big money at an event, they might think that this is a big deal. And that's really the best way that they have forward, is to just highlight the money over and over again. I mean, make it very obvious this is a very money-driven thing. If they do that, I think they've got something to work with. But if you come back to the DP World Tour and go, why would you let us play an $8 million purse event? Why don't you make us feel welcome? It just doesn't come across very well. I'm sorry, it doesn't. It's not very convincing otherwise. So I think if you're living with those players, you got to be like, look, we are hunkered down here. We are going to be on our own island, but we are going to reward you handsomely for staying on that island. Do not go anywhere else. You can only go to the majors. You got to stay in the other events. That's how I would look at it if I were them, but that might be their best path forward. The other thing I wanted to get to at the back end of this show very briefly is a fascinating story that was sent to me yesterday by Big Al Fitches on Twitter. You know, guy I've followed for a while, guy follows me. We have good conversations every now and then. Really a stunning story from the Robert Trent Jones Golf Trail. So if you've ever been down south to play golf, or if you live down south, particularly in Alabama, there's the Robert Trent Jones Golf Trail. It was kind of an ingenious thing at its time, kind of the state-sponsored idea of, well, we'll back this idea with tourism dollars and investments of building courses that were designed by Robert Trent Jones. And you would have all of these courses as kind of a, not exactly a trail, but really you could go around the state or portions of the state and play in these different courses, and you'd be checking off portions of the trail. And some courses are better than others. Some are more well-known than others. Some are connected to resorts. Some are connected to kind of hotels. Some are just kind of on their own a little bit. But I think what most people would agree, if not everyone would agree, is kind of the big dollar course, the fancy one, is Ross Bridge. And that's kind of the place where you're treated like you're paying for a resort course, you know, a big time resort course. Lots of great service, really good golf course, great setting. A lot of people like it. Unfortunately, there are going to be a lot of people that probably will not be able to play it this fall because something crazy happened there with a groundskeeping mistake that has basically nuked all the greens. So Sunbelt Golf Corporation operates the golf course. And what apparently happened is the maintenance staff mistook 1-ton bag of herbicide that kills grass for green sand, which wouldn't kill grass, which is something you usually kind of fill in with your fill bottle when you make a divot. And they spread the 1-ton bag of herbicide that they thought was green sand, and they put it on pretty much every green on the property, basically killing the bent grass greens on it, which, by the way, probably shouldn't be bent grass. They probably should not be bent grass. They probably should be a form of Bermuda at this point. I mean, my local club here, we're going to Bermuda almost certainly. I'd be shocked if we don't at this point in some fashion in the next couple of years. That the need for that has crept up, not the other way. Nevertheless, what they now have to do is basically try to flush as much of that herbicide out as they possibly can as quickly as possible, and then try to regrow what grass they have on those putting surfaces for the remainder of the fall and next spring, which is exactly their peak season, because summer is not the best time to play golf in Alabama. So what they've been trying to do is dry injecting coal and a what's called a ceramic layer to flush the poison out. I don't know how that works. I'm not an agronomist. I'm not going to pretend to be an agronomist. But what they're trying to do is basically mitigate the damage that's going to happen from the herbicide. And we all know what kind of herbicide is. I mean, there's different kinds. We've done some herbicide applications here this year that are basically not what they're called non-discriminatory, which means they kill anything and everything. And then there are other kind of herbicides that target specific types of things. Weeds, obviously, is a common one. Or maybe you're targeting like a Bermuda grass if you're trying to save rye or bent, you know, those types of things. So we don't know about that. But there's some big trouble here. And I think there's some, based on this reporting from WBRC, the possibility that they might just push ahead their timelines because they were thinking about trying to put in new greens, probably go to Bermuda. Well, they might just have to do it now. They might have just already herbicided the entire putting surfaces on the Rossbridge course and may find themselves needing to sprig right away and just wait for it to take a few weeks and that's it. You can't book a tee time at Rossbridge right now. So it's a big deal. Basically, they're going to lose probably millions of dollars in personal revenue to the course. Tax revenue on top of that, or as part of that, you know, that's hundreds of thousands of dollars. I mean, this is a multi-million dollar mistake. And it's really unfortunate for a property that obviously has a really good reputation, for a trail that generates lots of money, tax money every year for Alabama. It just stinks. I mean, I've seen significant mistakes in groundskeeping before at our home course. It's stuff. It's happened. Mistakes happen sometimes well beyond your control. This one's a little bit bigger, unfortunately. So hopefully for the folks at Rossbridge, they come up with a solution quickly, find some sprigs, throw them into the turf, and hopefully in, you know, 8-10 weeks, they've got some surface to work with again. But that really puts them at the end of the year. And it's going to, again, cost them a whole ton of money. Anyhow, that's going to do it for two off the first today. I'm Ryan Ballingy. Thank you for giving us a listen. If you subscribe to the show through a platform where you can give us a 5-star review, we really appreciate that. Either way, we'd take your feedback at Twitter, at Ryan Ballingy. You can find Golf News Now, your favorite social media service, at the handle Golf News Net. And we will talk to you tomorrow.